It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
You can't look at agriculture today without looking at what's happened over these last several decades. And one of the people that's been very involved in it is Dr. Chuck Binbrook. And Chuck was engaged at the USDA, at the National Academy of Sciences. He's worked with the Organic Trade Center. He is a consultant. And I'm pleased to have Chuck with me today because, Chuck, I think in your career, I'm going to make this as a compliment to you, you have been controversial sometimes because reports you've been involved with have not been exactly what everybody wanted to hear. And I think it starts back with even in the 80s when you were involved in preparing a report about alternative agriculture. And at that time, we were still coming off of years of back when Earl Butz was Secretary of Agriculture, and everything was very, very commodity-oriented. And it was a new idea to talk about alternative agriculture, and they thought it was a niche, and certainly it's evolved so far beyond that in the period of time since. But in a way, you were involved in looking at this back as this all was taking place. And I wonder if you could, first of all, let's turn the clock back to the 80s, mm-hmm. when you were involved with identifying alternative agriculture. I'm curious, could you kind of set that up as to what you were looking at and where that led you and some of the ideas these reports were coming up with, the picture it was painting of where agriculture was heading?
Well, sure. I was a staff guy. I was the executive director of the Board on Agriculture in the National Academy of Sciences. And as all academy projects, the way that they unfold is a team of scientists is recruited and brought together to form a committee. And it's the committee that really does the projects and writes the reports. My job was to make sure that they all came together and support them and provide background material. And it was really these scientists that brought to this project within the National Academy of Sciences their sense of what was not healthy, what was kind of going south in agriculture. And clearly, the water quality issues, the nitrates in water, the pesticides, the beginnings of serious problems with resistance, more on the insect and entomology side in the 80s than herbicides. But today, the big story in agriculture are glyphosate-resistant weeds that are spread all over the country and really are one of the very serious challenges that farmers
face. We didn't
even
talk about glyphosate, though, back in the 80s.
No, it wasn't on the radar screen. Back then it was Alachlor or atrazine or mm-hmm. 2,4-D. But so there were water quality issues. There was still serious soil erosion and declining soil quality. We call it soil health today. Mm-hmm. And there were structural issues. And don't forget, that the 80s was the decade that livestock agriculture really made the transition to CAFOs, to large-scale industrial enclosed systems with manure lagoons, heavy reliance on subtherapeutic use of antibiotics, and really created a whole new set of public health and environmental problems. So that's what the report addressed. The committee...
Let me stop you there for a second then. So when you say that's what it addressed, so it was looking at the fact that agriculture was getting larger, it was getting large scale, like you said, these industrial type operations. So was the report saying these are the consequences of how this is evolving and that policy needs to take that into account and possibly take some actions or pass laws or rules or regulations to try to keep that in check?
The recommendations chapter in the Alternative Agriculture Report is something I'm still very proud of. It's almost as applicable today to the next Farm Bill as it was to the 1990 Farm Bill. And it had our report had quite an impact on the 1990 Farm Bill.
What were some of the things in it?
We had done a report called Investing in Research that really was the foundation for the new competitive grant program that was authorized in the 1990 Farm Bill. Mm-hmm. probably another big and valuable impact of the work was setting the stage for. Remember, the 1990 Farm Bill, it had swamp buster, sod buster, conservation compliance, and the CRP, that suite of new conservation programs that was, started in the 85 Farm Bill and evolved to the next level in the 1990 Farm Bill. So those issues were impacted by what was in that report. And, I think it stood the test of time quite well.
Would the commodity organizations and the general farm organizations, were they resistant or were they in opposition and they to the direction suggested in the report?
I think they were nervous about the call for more attention to nitrates in drinking water, more attention to pesticide dietary risks and the impact of pesticide exposures on things like birth defects and cancer. These are not pleasant topics and not things that, the average farmer and certainly not the commodity organizations wanted a lot of public attention to. And in the livestock side, by far the most sensitive issue was antibiotic resistance, which was, it was a very serious problem back then.
30 years ago?
Yeah, you're darn right.
Still is today.
It still is today. That's exactly right.
And then what was it? Maybe a decade or so before we get the organic law that period.
So the Organic Farming Production Act was in the 1990 Farm Bill.
Mm-hmm.
Speaker Foley was the primary sponsor of it, got it into the Farm Bill. And then remember, it took 12 years to do the rule?
Yeah.
It was 2002 that the.
Right.
Remember, they had 350,000 comments, and they were about sewage sludge, biotech, and radiation were the three big issues, remember?
Right.
So it took USDA 12 years to finalize the rule, and of course, there was the authorizing statute, OFPA, called for this National Organic Standards Board, which was convened. I think it was in place by 1992, but there have always been a lot of devils in the details of organic and organic requirements and rules and what you can use and what you can't use. And it took a decade for the broader organic community to sort that out through the rulemaking process to where USDA had a final rule that set the rules of the road for building the organic industry starting in 2002.
So you fast forward today, and every supermarket in the country has got organic products, some more than others. But have you been surprised at how fast it's evolved from that point of time? Because you've got quite a sweep of perspective back talking alternative agriculture, seeing what was going on around the organic law being formed, how long it took it to take place. And today consumers have choices as to whether or not they want to purchase organic, which they certainly didn't have 20 years ago, not to the degree they have now. Has it surprised you, or in some ways is it not living up to what your hopes were?
Well, it does surprise me greatly that organic production doesn't account for the majority of fruit and vegetable production in this country, because it would be completely feasible technically to produce 80 or 90% of fruits and vegetables organically. We don't need new research. We don't need new technology. We know we can do it. We're 40% of the packaged baby greens grown in California is organic.
Is that right? 40%?
40%. It's spinach is at 25%. Up in the Pacific Northwest, where I live in Washington State, there's 15% of apples, 20% of cherries. It can be done at large scale, and what surprises me, that even in the mid 90s, when there wasn't a lot of data about the consumer benefits and the environmental and soil health benefits of organic, there was enough information to back up some substantial consumer and environmental benefits of organic farming on a lot of the big ticket issues, fertilizer and pesticides and drinking water, pesticide residues and its impact on public health and in particular farm workers. Soil health, the loss of nutrients down the Mississippi and the dead zone in the Gulf, antibiotics in CAFOs, organic. It was clear that organic production systems essentially eliminated or avoided most of the big ticket chemical, toxic management and animal drug issues that were on the table. And given that the technology and the systems have been available for the last 15 years to shift much more acreage, it really has surprised me that the growth has been so slow, and it's been such hard sledding, in particular in the fruit and vegetable area, is the most significant thing that brings new consumers to organic is concern over pesticide residues and exposure, and pregnancy and childhood, and the growth, you know, the healthy development of children. And, you know, it's the 90% of the exposure to pesticides for the average American is from fruits and vegetables in the diet. And we could have
90%?
Yeah, about 90%. There's essentially no pesticides in the livestock side of the diet. None. There's no pesticides in eggs. There's very few pesticides in milk. There's virtually none.
Right, sure.
You can maybe find a little bit in kidney or liver, but the livestock side doesn't contribute. And in the grains, very little until some of the recent changes. You know, the use of glyphosate as a pre-harvest desiccant to assist harvest, that's actually created a pretty significant exposure to glyphosate through grain-based products.
Well, let's talk about glyphosate for a minute, and I think we need to translate that because it's the active ingredient in Roundup.
Correct.
And probably people that live in the city have it in their garage right now to go out and spray it on their sidewalks, so that's where they come into contact with it. But Roundup has been kind of a notorious product because it's been part of the whole GMO issue. And so you've had Roundup Ready soybeans and Roundup corn. I guess you've looked at that. You've been involved in studies looking at glyphosate, which again is part of Roundup. Where do you find that issue today? Has it evolved? Has it improved? How would you size up this Roundup or glyphosate issue today?
I think the history will look back at this era of near universal adoption of herbicide-resistant technology, which would be Roundup Ready, corn, soybeans, and cotton, and more recently, sugar beets and alfalfa, as a really lost opportunity, kind of a tragic episode where technology that could have been used and really helped farmers and actually helped the environment ended up being adopted and used in a way that maximized the profits for companies like Pioneer and Monsanto and Syngenta, but abused the technology and deployed it in a way that really sowed the seeds of its destruction. The spread of glyphosate-resistant weeds now, it's killing that technology. It has a few years left in it, but you know, it's just not going to be valuable to farmers in the Midwest 3 or 4 years from now when, you know, glyphosate will still kill, it'll still control dozens of weeds in the Midwest, but there'll be also a dozen or so that are resistant. And so farmers are not going to be willing to pay the premium for glyphosate-resistant seed, pay all, you know, money for two applications of glyphosate, and then have to go out and spray 2,4-D or dicamba and 3 or 4 other active ingredients to deal with the resistant weeds.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about this technology, because I hear in your comments, I think almost a note of a potential. That is it right to assume, Chuck, that you could see that it could have been used better, that the technologies of genetic engineering could have been much better utilized than you think it has been with glyphosate?
Well, let's specifically talk about herbicide resistance technology,
okay,
which is Roundup Ready. In the early years, it's Roundup Ready soybeans, Roundup Ready corn, and Roundup Ready cotton. In the early years, all the farmers that adopted this technology in 96, 97, really on through the early 2000s, it was the most incredibly robust and effective and simple weed management system that farmers had ever had in anywhere in the world. It just was so easy and so effective. And because of that, farmers said, well, we're just going to do it every year. And they rotated Roundup Ready soybeans with Roundup Ready corn. And so the weed communities were being exposed to glyphosate year in and year out. And that started the selection process for first less sensitive weeds and then truly genetically resistant weeds, the weeds that had had some mutation. But weed scientists at the time, the leading weed scientists say, if farmers plant Roundup Ready crops year in and year out, there will be enough selection pressure on weed communities that resistance will become a problem and kind of kill the goose that laid the golden egg. Monsanto was warned multiple times by many of the top academic weed scientists not to allow Roundup Ready crops to be planted year in and year out on the same acres. But the market dynamics and the need to make as much money and get as much market share, Monsanto could not resist taking over the herbicide market and then buying up, of course, half of the seed industry to deliver the technology. And that put us on this incredibly tragic and unnecessary course where certainly already the cotton industry in the Southeast hasn't collapsed completely, but the Roundup Ready technology is not very important down there anymore because there's too many resistant weeds. The same thing is going to happen with corn and soybeans over the next 2 or 3 years. Imagine instead if the industry had gotten together in 1996 and said, look, this is very powerful technology. Let's all agree that glyphosate and Roundup Ready crops can only be planted once every 3 years on the same acre. Right. If they had done that, which is what the academic weed community was more or less recommending, to prevent the emergence of resistance. If that had been done, we wouldn't have all these super weeds, we wouldn't have herbicide use going through the roof, and farmers could deploy the technology to deal with their problem fields in an elegant, simple way, much better than having to go out and moldboard plow and do a bunch of tillage. So it was a technology that if it had been deployed with more discipline, it would have lasted. It still would have made a lot of money for the companies because they could have charged even more for it because it would be used to deal with problem fields. And it wouldn't have become the lightning rod for opposition to genetically engineered crops.
What about consumer safety? How do you feel about the studies? Europe's come up with some studies about glyphosate. Do you find those convincing?
Well, for years, glyphosate had this pristine mammalian toxicology and environmental health profile. The Monsanto folks went around and said, well, it breaks down into carbon, nitrogen, and other couple molecules. It's just, they convinced farmers, the public health community, and a lot of regulators for 20 or 30 years that glyphosate was just slightly more toxic than table salt. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, just because they heard it so much and there was nobody saying anything to the contrary, glyphosate got this reputation as being essentially benign. Well, we know now it's not completely benign. It's a probable human carcinogen as classified by the International Agency for Research on Cancer. And, it's almost certainly a risk factor for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. That's why there's hundreds and probably soon to be thousands of farmers and horticulturalists and other people that sprayed a lot of Roundup over the years that have sued Monsanto because of the contribution of exposures to glyphosate, and not just glyphosate, but also the inert ingredients in it that's in Roundup. Mm-hmm. Glyphosate is 100% pure chemical. No farmer ever sprayed just glyphosate. They sprayed glyphosate along with a set of inert ingredients and surfactants that changed the biological properties and the environmental fate of the chemical. And it's really the public health risks that we're now coming to understand are clearly associated with formulated glyphosate with the presence of these inert ingredients. But the entire regulatory infrastructure for Roundup herbicides, for glyphosate-based herbicides, only focuses on glyphosate. So it's kind of like judging the public health risk of guns in the absence of ammunition.
All right.
Not a lot of people are going to get killed by handguns if there's no ammunition.
Right.
So, but in fact, the public health risks associated with Roundup herbicides is this combination of inert ingredients and glyphosate that really changes the toxicological properties and the risk. And unfortunately, the scientific community around the world has now recognized that there's this huge gap, because there are essentially no studies, toxicological studies, on formulated glyphosate products. And I think the expectation is if the studies that were done on pure glyphosate in the 70s and 80s, which are the studies that support the current tolerances and the current use, if they were redone today with formulated glyphosate herbicide products, the results would be much more worrisome from a public health point of view. There's dozens of studies, literally dozens of studies, in the peer-reviewed literature comparing the toxicity of formulated glyphosate-based herbicides to studies based on the active ingredient alone. And depending upon what organism is used in the study and what the endpoint, what the adverse mm-hmm. biological effect is, the formulated product is never less than 10 times more toxic, and there's some where it's 200 times more toxic.
Well, you know, when I hear you say this, it makes, you know, I think about, well, where we are right now, there are new technologies coming on board. CRISPR is talked about. You know, gene editing, where we can flip switches and so forth. I mean, are you optimistic that we will have learned the lessons of utilizing these technologies in ways that they don't come up with these unintended consequences as we have?
No, I'm not optimistic. I mean, take the Simplot potato, the innate potato, which uses gene silencing technology to turn down the gene that produces the acrylamide in potatoes. And when you make French fries out of potatoes,
which is a carcinogen.
Yeah, acrylamide is a pretty potent carcinogen. And reducing the level of acrylamide in potatoes is a good thing.
Sure.
It's a good thing. I'm glad that they did it. But Simplot knew that there would be this consumer skepticism. And they should have bit the bullet and done the careful studies with their potatoes. The odds are very high that they wouldn't have found any issues, but they didn't do it. And you know, the innate potatoes, they're in the market at a certain level, but I think again, there was a way to bring that technology on where Consumers Union and EWG and other groups would say, this is a good application of that technology because it's reducing substantially exposures to a proven and fairly potent human carcinogen. But do you hear anybody from the environmental community thanking Simplot for bringing that potato on the market? No. No, you don't, because they just didn't go that extra mile, and it's a shame.
Well, let's kind of wrap up here about talking about the extra mile, because you've had a long engagement. You've seen these issues. You've seen these controversies, and many people have heard of Dr. Chuck Benbrook and the reports you've been involved with and the studies you've been involved with, and there have been lessons learned, I think. But if you look ahead from the point we are right now, and you've continued to be engaged, you're doing consulting, you've worked with the organic industry, you've got you very much have your oars still in the water in so many different ways. And I'm curious, Chuck, what makes you the most optimistic? If we look at this next period, what gives you hope that there's something that can be getting better than what we've experienced in the recent past?
Well, I think the what makes me optimistic is that consumer demand, not just in the U.S. but worldwide, and specifically for California agriculture and the growth of organic in California, there is huge and rapidly growing demand for organic fruits and vegetables, and in particular, processed, stable, preserved fruit and vegetable-based products across the Pacific Rim. And
those what does that mean, processed, stable?
Well, it means things like jams and jellies, frozen fruit. So the fresh organic produce, the fresh organic produce market just isn't going to grow that fast in the Western United States. It's going to grow some. I mean, like I said, some of the leafy greens are already 25-30% market share. In the case of the baby leafy greens, it's at 40% of the market share is organic. So clearly that's at scale, and it's a small margin. And across the board, I don't care whether we're talking about pistachios or cucumbers or onions or tomatoes or grapes or apples, when any of those industries get to about 15% organic, they're capturing most of the infrastructure and scale-related economic benefits that the conventional food industry captures. That's happened in Washington State. Washington State could convert most of its fruit and vegetable production to organic if the demand were there. The demand's not there now, so they don't convert. But what makes me optimistic is that consumers around the world are becoming aware that food quality and food choices matter, particularly for women that are pregnant and for infants and developing children. Exposure at the wrong time to even minute levels of certain pesticides can disrupt the normal genetic development of an infant and have adverse lifelong consequences. The science is really clear on that. And the reason that I'm surprised that organic fruit and vegetable production hasn't grown faster is there's been such a clear public health and scientific case supporting the benefits of it that, you know, it's hard to explain why all of the apples that school kids across the country get through the school lunch program aren't organic. I mean, why should any of them have four? The average conventional apple has four or five pesticide residues on it.
Is it price? I mean, is that because oftentimes they're on tight budgets to buy the food that's necessary for the school system? And I would assume in many cases, organics are still higher priced than conventional.
That's true. And again, we have to remember that. So leafy greens has made the move to scale, and it's only a 5 or 10% premium. And you know, a lot of school districts to serve safer, higher quality, more nutritious food to the kids would think that was a reasonable investment. You know, higher quality food, less health problems down the road. It's kind of a no-brainer. But we still have to get fruit and vegetable production up to that 10 or 15%. We're not there, even in California, for a lot of crops. So there's this. That's why this Grow Organic initiative that seems to be gaining some steam here in California, to me, is so promising because it has potential to accelerate getting to the point where the scale of the organic production and all the way from growers to, you know, distribution and retail gets to the scale where efficiencies and economies of scale bring that price differential down to certainly no more than 15%, and in some cases as low as 5%. Then I think it can really take off, and I don't think the impetus for organic fruit and vegetable production really taking off in California and say accounting for 2/3 of fruit and vegetable production in the state. It isn't going to come from government. It's not going to come from public research investments. It's going to come from demand from consumers and the opportunity to make money.
So Dr. Chuck Benbrook, I really appreciate having this conversation today on Farm to Table Talk. Thanks for being with me.
My pleasure. Thanks.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com and follow us on SoundCloud, Facebook, and Twitter, or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.